There may be no battlefield in the world where the marks of what happened are better preserved than on Kiska in the Aleutians. But it wasn't really a battle. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today, we're going back more than 60 years to the time when Japan invaded American soil. Your calls are welcome as we discuss the war in the Aleutians. The number, statewide, toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. Email talk@APRN.org. What we have now learned about World War II in the Aleutians, the subject today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Alaska Children's Trust, sponsor of the Alaska Parent Line, providing parenting information, 1-800-643-5437.
So it was last week at the Anchorage Museum when a new exhibition went up of some artifacts, both Japanese and American artifacts, some cartoons from a newspaper published during World War II out in the Aleutians, and above all, some photographs, some really incredible photographs taken of mostly Kiska. What's left on Kiska today from when the Japanese troops withdrew before the island was retaken. He's not the curator. I don't know what we call him, but he's the consultant who took the photographs and who gave a presentation, including some motion pictures and so forth, that just really could not be seen in any other way because of copyrights and so forth, who basically kept a crowd of people, a capacity crowd in the Anchorage Museum, completely riveted for his presentation. Guy's name is Dirk Spenneman. He is professor of cultural heritage management at Charles Sturt University in Australia. And he is out in the Aleutians at this very moment. He joins us by military telephone connection from Shemya. Dirk, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Stephen, and thank you for having me on the program.
I'm just very delighted. We have an absolute gold mine here, and I'm going to try and keep my mouth shut and let you and my other guests hold forth as much as possible and mention the phone number from time to time, which is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, because I suspect you have already learned that there are many people in Alaska who have a deep interest in this subject and a good deal of knowledge that really hasn't yet entirely been codified, that we still have a little bit of living history and people who have done a lot of research and secondhand research from there. So we may get some of that on the program today. I think where we want to start is why the Kiska battlefield is so unique.
I think that's the key point. The essence is its uniqueness. The Kiska battlefield is unique for one simple reason. The island has been largely uninhabited, essentially uninhabited before and after the war. There were Aleuts living, of course, on Kiska, but they got removed by the Russians in the 1820s, and then until the beginning of World War II, when the Japanese landed on the 7th of June, their time, there was very little human habitation. So you've got no landscape modification, basically at a more or less natural environment. Then you've got this massive influx of Japanese building, you know, gun emplacements, building tent barracks, building roads, etc. And then they leave, or they get bombed on very heavily. So you've got this heavy layer of bombing, bomb craters, destroyed areas, etc. And then you've got the American landings, and the Americans do the same thing. To deny Kiska, the Japanese coming back to it, they basically put a garrison on there, they build tent bases, they build piers, etc. So, and then nothing. When they leave in late 45, end of 46, it reverts back to the Wildlife Refuge, and there's no one there. So nowhere in the world do we have a battlefield where you don't have this layering of human habitation and secondary reuse, etc. Kiska is a battlefield pure and simple. And frankly, you can see almost every, if we had a few more historic images of bomb raids, which we could, if we had all of those, you could literally tell the battle blow by blow in the landscape. And the battle, of course, is not hand-to-hand combat. It's not gun combat as you have it elsewhere, where the Marines attacking, or and on Attu, for example. On Kiska, it is one of those modern air battles, a long-range battle, where you do have bomb craters, where you do have shot-down aircraft, but where you also had, and where you also have the guns which did the deed. So it's one of those remote battles, and that in itself is unique. In its preservation. So globally, we don't have it anywhere else. And that I find this totally spectacular.
So it must have been quite a lot of responsibility. And I noticed that you responded with these photographs, which really, I think, approach the level of art. Can you tell me a little bit of the story of why you were so motivated to do these?
The fact is, look, I'm an historic preservationist, as you would call it in the U.S., and I have to take documentary photographs. And to be honest to your listeners, a normal documentary photograph is really important, but it makes your eyes bleed. I mean, it's boring. You know, no, really, they're painful. But we need them, you know, straight-on photos for measuring, for documentation, etc. But no one responds to them. And I learned very quickly with my own students that if you take photographs from different angles, which are non-documentary, of course, but they're very evocative. People respond. You get the same message across, but very differently. And so I've started to take two types of photographs. As a normal consultant or paratic professional, I teach this stuff. You take normal photos, and then you look at different angles to see, for example, an image I like a lot is an American tractor trailer. It's a power trailer. It's just a caterpillar sitting in the tundra. But you can photograph that straight on and it's boring, or you can photograph in a way that you're almost being run over by it if you're the viewer, and it immediately gets a different response. And so I've tried to get emotive imagery of both American and Japanese installations on that island, which captures the way I see the war. I mean, it's drab, it's cold, it's dreary, but at the same time we have an amazing amount of material culture still there. I mean, that I find it stunning as a heritage professional that you can stand in front of an emplacement, and there is the tent. It's collapsed in a heap, but it's still there.
Wow.
For preservation-wise, this is just amazing. And it's a factor of cold and fog, but it's an amazing preservation. And so this brings it home. There are real people there. It's not just, you know, war is quite often so abstract and generic. It's not. It's real people fighting it, and there is the physical evidence. And I'm trying with my modern photography to bring that to the viewer, to the audience who can't go out there.
I'd like to turn now to my other guest in the studio. He is Peter Porco. He's a journalist, a writer, playwright of Windblown and Dripping, which was commissioned by Cyrano's Theater Company as part of its 50 Years Statehood series. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Pete about this play some time ago, and it's now completed its run. But it's basically about the troops in the Aleutians, and more particularly about Dashiell Hammett, the famed American mystery writer, who was much older than most of these troops there, but still managed to find a way to get himself into military service during the war, and essentially mentored these younger people, putting out this military newspaper. Pete, I ran into you at the museum there, and you went to Dirk's presentation. What do you make of these photographs?
Well, I was amazed at them because, as what he said, many of them hadn't been seen before, and particularly, I mean, there was a lot of artistry in what he took, as he just explained, but also he came up with things that had not been photographed before, or rather, we hadn't seen the photos, including the Japanese versions, their side of it, and I was particularly impressed by the videos that he came forward with. I mean, I don't know anybody who's seen those. I think you're right. Isn't it true, Dirk, that they hadn't been seen before? So don't talk about
the video clips come from a Japanese newsreel, news camera, which would happen to be there in the first days. And that was actually produced later on, made available in Japan, and is part of an historic sort of film series.
So they probably are.
Most people in this world haven't seen them because, you know, unless you know where to look, they just disappeared, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some of this, there's copyright and so forth, so you can present it in a theater, but basically not exhibit it, right?
I can't exhibit it as a whole for permanence, and the other part is that I can't exhibit the whole shot, or a series, of course, because this copyright is still not totally clear whether it's out of copyright or it's not, and trying to negotiate with some of those agencies is a bit, how should I put it, arcane. So I, for my public lecture, I could have very short clips which stay within the parameters of copyright and research, etc., without making it a public projection, etc., which is a totally different ballgame.
So, do you think do you think that the work that has been done with Kiska and probably will later be done with Attu is going to be something special in terms of the context of military history? In other words, did you find out some new stuff?
I think I have to acknowledge my colleague, Dr. Wakako Higuchi, who is collaborating with me on all of that stuff. She works in Guam. Her connections she's managed to pull up over the last 20 years, she's now put to bear, basically, into the Kiska situation. And yes, there's new stuff coming up, because we now have the other side of the story. And we have imagery which you haven't seen before, which, you know, all the Japanese imagery we had before, except for a few captured one and a couple of famous ones, is basically a scene from an American aircraft from the top dropping the bombs down, and a few low-level flying oblique photos. So now we've got the ground imagery. We can work out what they were doing. And when you talk to evacuees or survivors, or they talk to Japanese veterans, you can also learn how they felt when the bombs fell and how much impact it actually had. And it is a bit intriguing to learn that the American bombing had not that much impact on the Japanese morale at the time. It would have been after Attu had fallen and a base was erected there, then the life would have been very different, but they pulled out before. So during that part, basically, when the bombers came, Mr. Izami Toshiharu, one of the commanders, told me, well, we just went in our bunkers and hid and just waited as the bombers went, and then we got out again and fixed what got damaged. And because of the nature of American bombing by virtue of anti-aircraft fire, etc., the bombing was fairly high level. So a lot of there was very little damage done given the inaccuracy of bombing caused by altitude, and I think I wondered sometimes why, because in you have high altitude bombing in Europe and it's quite accurate, and I wonder whether the US forces did not take into account the variable wind speeds you have here. And if, you know, if you've got 20 knot winds blowing and you drop a bomb from 11,000 feet, it will be deflected a bit, and that may account for the inaccuracy. That needs to be done a bit more research, but ultimately they were not that heavily affected by it. It would delay things, and there were some really lucky hits. I mean, the Americans didn't know this, U.S. forces, but they sank a transport ship, and unbeknownst to them, it was possibly the most essential one they could have sunk. It had the heavy equipment the Japanese were shipping to the island to build the airfield. Had that equipment got through, then the airfield might have well been completed in time, which would have not changed the war, but certainly delayed it and made it much more costly for the U.S. Air Force.
Yeah, I want to. You brought up the wind, and I want to try and draw a contrast right now. You showed basically the kind of shelter, the earth sheltering technique that the Japanese used on the island, and apparently it was quite effective.
Yes, I think they must have learned it from the Aleuts, but they, whom they'd visited before, but they were basically digging a small hole in the ground, and then put their barracks up, and then they stacked tundra sod. They cut out sod and grass from the patches and stacked them up like bricks filled with more earth. And so basically the entire building was surrounded by a soil wall as high as the roof, and then they covered the roof with more tundra. Now, that's not for camouflage, because you can see them absolutely easily from the air, as we can see from American bomb photos. But it basically cuts the wind out. And the intriguing part is, and this is, I'm very excited I'm here in Shemya right now, because the intriguing part is on Kiska, all the American bases, the Americans did the same, they'd sort of recessed their tents a bit, but these walls are knee-high or a bit higher, and so they must have been really cold in their pyramid tents. Whereas here on Shemya, I'm amazed to see that you've got the same going on. You've got American barracks and tent encampment bases in World War II, but here the walls are much higher than Kiska. So either the guys in Kiska were told not to dig it high. I don't know. That's something to be worked out. But certainly here the Americans did the high ones as well, whereas in Kiska they didn't. But once you're in those these sort of soul walls, I mean, the wind might be as much howling as it wants outside. Once you're in him, it's just totally warm and cozy. The wind's blocked out, so the miserable conditions don't exist. So if you do the right barracks technique, you're actually quite okay. It's not a problem.
Let's turn now to the American side and Dashiell Hammett and his intrepid little newspaper operation out there in the Aleutian with Pete Porco. They were cold in those Quonset huts, weren't they?
They not only were they cold, but there was a lot of internal condensation, so there were always puddles on the floor. And since they were Quonset huts, they could never stand up against the wall, so everybody was sort of concentrated in the middle. they were quite tight. Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of room.
Well, one thing that comes out in the exhibition is the sense of humor of the cartoonists, and you must have gone through a lot of issues of that little newspaper they were putting out there.
Right, I did. Yeah, there's only, I think, probably, there might be only one set, near complete set of the Adakian, that was the newspaper in the world, and I did get to go through it. But there's also, and of course, the cartoons were very big. They were a very big feature of the paper, and they made fun of just those things that drove the soldiers mad. That's why they were so good. And Hammett was the one who was very big on cartoons, and he also wrote a lot of the captions. He had a great sense of humor. And the cartoons were eventually published, at least 150 of them by three different artists, were eventually published in a small booklet called Wind Blown and Dripping. That's where I got the title of my play from. And and it's actually still available online. You can find copies of it now and then. It's a rare book, so you pay quite a bit for it. But anyway, and of course, I noticed that in the exhibit that's at the museum, they have, in fact, hung up some of these cartoons, copies of these cartoons, and they're really hilarious. And they're a great little feature of it.
Well, now, Dashiell Hammett was a... Your play basically... creates a drama out of this. You don't know really, you know, how it's not exactly trying to tell you the truth of the way things were. You needed to create a drama. But the situation itself is pretty dramatic, wouldn't you say? First off, that Hammett, who was really older than your World War II soldier, so more of a World War I kind of guy, is really in a... It's amazing he ever passed a physical, let me put it that way.
It's very amazing. He tried twice and failed, and then finally he made it the third time because I think they relaxed the standards. This was in the summer of 1942, and they had manpower
needs. So how old would he be then?
He was 48 years old.
Yeah.
And he had served in World War I. He was a veteran, and I think he was discharged a corporal. And although he didn't go to Europe, he stayed in the States. But yeah, he was pretty unhealthy. He had he didn't have a good tooth in his mouth. He was a former tuberculosis patient. He had TB for quite a long time. He was real thin. He was about 6'1", about 140 pounds. And here he wants to go and he wants to fight the Nazis, but they didn't send him into action.
and generally speaking, for the American side, Aleutian's duty apparently was kind of like sending them to Siberia.
It was
they were putting the subversives and the sexually suspect and so forth. They're sending them all out there to get them out of the mainstream of the military.
It's not an exaggeration. Siberia is not an exaggeration. It really they were miserable. There were psychiatric reports about how bad it was for those soldiers. They really suffered all kinds of things because it wasn't just the climate. Which was terrible. It was either raining or snowing, or it was always blowing, and it could blow 40 miles an hour, and you could still have fog. It was the strangest weather they'd ever seen, and only rarely did the sun come out. So it was not only just the weather, though, because it was also the isolation. They had nowhere to go. There were no towns. There was no civilian familiarity that what they knew in the States, and so a lot of them really sort of lost their minds. I mean, some people obviously adapted. They went with however bad it was, but boy, did they gripe.
You know, the thing is, Dirk Spenneman, joining us from Shemya, what really strikes me as I delve deeper and deeper into this war in the Aleutians is the inherent drama of the whole thing. I mean, when I first got here, they said, well, you know, this is the only, this was out in the Aleutians, is the only American soil the Japanese occupied. And they really did, and everybody's forgotten about it. And that's all kind of true, even though it was making headlines at the time. But it's just so inherently dramatic. The more you look at it, the more dramatic it becomes. First off, the kind of soldiers were there. That's interesting. The geostrategic situation with the how the war could have been quite different if Midway Island hadn't, if the Japanese succeeded in taking Midway, and all of a sudden all the supply lines could be linked. So there's the strategic side, but also just the raw drama of the military actions themselves. Surely a lot of boredom and paperwork and so forth, you know, which is most of what the military is waiting around and doing paperwork. But at the same time, the actions were so amazing. I mean, first off, the Battle of Attu was a huge battle with enormous thousands of casualties and huge numbers of wounded. And then you get to Kiska, and the Japanese somehow managed to get off of that island before they are invaded. Now, this is after Attu's been taken, and I guess the handwriting was on the wall, right, Dirk Spenneman, that they would need to get out of Kiska because they couldn't be supplied anymore.
No, that's right. I mean, Attu is, the moment Attu fell, the Japanese made a decision to hold Attu if they could, and it was very clear, of course, they didn't. And it was very, very, very bloody battle and very costly for the United States. It was even more costly for the Japanese because basically by, I think, 23, the entire garrison of several thousand got wiped out. It's one of the, it was a Japanese approach that you just don't surrender in this case. However, and there was a big, apparently a very, very big ceremony in Tokyo, burial ceremony with empty boxes, of course, of empty boxes of ashes, etc. So politically, the Japanese could play this up as the heroic stand, etc. Domestically, you could not sustain a second loss of that order. At the same time, the writing for Kiska was on the wall. Okay, there's Attu. You can't get to Kiska without going near Attu. If once Attu has an airfield on it, you have got search patrols going out by the United States, and that's the end of any supply. So Kiska was basically doomed. At the same time, it was also clear that Kiska's life would have been horrible, any soldier's life there, because once there's an airfield on Attu and you've got it on Amchitka, you know, they can just shuttle bomb, you know, take off from Amchitka, drop their bombs on Kiska, fly onto Attu, rearm, refuel, on the way back home, you drop another load of bombs. And so, you know, it's just clear that you can't hold it. So the Japanese politically couldn't, well, militarily couldn't hold it. Politically, they couldn't afford another, you know, disaster like that. So they decided to pull out, which is unique because it hasn't happened anywhere else. In the Guadalcanal, they were sort of regrouping, but not a real evacuation. But there, a complete base was abandoned. And they tried three times. The first time round, a couple of ships collided in the fog and they didn't get anywhere. Finally, in the third attempt on the 29th of July, they make it. And which is bizarre, it's just an amazing story. But keep in mind, it's before global radar and all this kind of stuff. They had radar, but it wasn't as effective. So 14 ships sneak into the harbor under the cover of fog, drop anchor, and less than an hour later, the Japanese have managed to board 5,100 soldiers and get out of the harbor unseen, undetected, and then got away. It's a bit of a blow to the, you know, pride of the United States Navy that they didn't detect them. I mean, it's the fog, of course, helped. The Japanese exploited this to the hilt, of course, as the biggest propaganda coup. You know, look, we pulled out and you still think we're there.
You know, Dirk, there's another story here I think I've heard, which is that the United States was distracted by some blips on the horizon, some radar blips to the southwest, I think.
The Battle of the Komondorsky is another distraction option, but it still shouldn't have occurred the way it did. That was not a plan by the Japanese. That's an earlier battle. The story of the blips.
There were blips at the same time, roughly at the same time as the evacuation, but the United States commanders were focused on these. And some people have speculated that it might have been a flight of birds or something that showed up on radar to the southwest. And I think Brian Garfield wrote about this in an essay for Alaska at War for that conference that was held here in 1995. Anyway,
yes.
Go ahead.
Now, The distraction may well be, but the upshot is that for the Japanese was that they managed to pull it out. You could have done, I mean, I could have, would have, should have. There are all sorts of options, like sure. permanently stationing submarines at the harbor, making sure no one gets in. But then, you know, we had that situation before where the Grunion got sunk by a merchant ship of all things. War is in vagaries. It's scary. I mean, you mentioned the Battle of Midway early on, and it went so terribly right for the United States with sinking four carriers, but absolutely horribly wrong for the Japanese. At the same time, it's a turn of a card of half an hour, and things could have been absolutely different. And that's sort of as an archaeologist / history preservationist looking into military history, it is frightening how much the war can depend on the turn of a card in for a very short moment. And so, in this case, it went right for the Japanese. They pulled out. And the sad thing is that the American commanders afterwards did not want to believe that the Japanese had gone. I mean, the intelligence reports saw that none of the landing barges or trucks had moved for days, but they all were worried that they had gone in the hills as they had with Attu. And so there was a deception in the end, but it was more or less clear that no one was there. The assumption was, well, we'll do it as a dress rehearsal. And it became a very costly dress rehearsal with, you know, 700 casualties and fatalities as a result of, you know, friendly fire and booby traps, etc.
Was it 700?
No, several hundred.
Several hundred.
I think 100 and some fatalities in yeah. total is about close to 300 injuries, etc. So it's a sad loss. After that one, then strategies changed, and the systematic bypassing could be done.
We're talking with Dirk Spenneman, professor of cultural heritage management from Australia, who's out in Shimya and going to do his presentation on the War of the Aleutians out there. And we're joined by a caller from Willow. Haynes, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Very good. Very good. You're on the line with Dirk Spenneman.
Okay, well, this question is for Dirk. This is a fascinating subject, and I'm really glad it's on the program this morning. I personally have been as far south as Umnak Island and seen Fort Glenn from the air, and it is just amazing how massive it is, so I can't imagine what Kiska and Attu look like. But my question, and I can take it on the air, I have two. First question, how do you deal with unexploded ordnance when you're on these islands? I mean, I understand that their booby traps are still in place, and they could still be just as lethal as the day they were put there 60 years ago.
Yeah, you're damn right. Okay, what's the other question?
And the second question is I understand that there is a Japanese memorial that Japan had actually paid to have put on the island.
Oh, that too.
I watched an independent film at one point that went through the feelings of World War II veterans and how they really didn't feel that it was in their place to have that monument there. Even though our relations have changed since the 40s, the impact that has on what the Japanese did during the 40s to the United States.
Right. Thank you very much for that very perceptive call. And Dirk Spenneman, before you, well, let's take the ordnance question first, and then the memorial we'll do after the break. It's definitely risky to be on Kiska still, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, any battlefield, any site which has seen naval shelling or aerial bombing will have unexploded ammunition. In addition, of course, there once was Japanese unexploded ammunition. We have historic photos by American soldiers, private photos, others showing them next to, you know, showing off the ammunition they see. Most of that ammunition would have either been removed or is buried. It's no longer there. The unexploded stuff is the stuff you've got to be worried about. There may well be booby traps in some caves which haven't been seen, but most of that would be gone. What is really the worry is more heavy, you know, large American aerial bombs which just dropped in the tundra and didn't explode and then get covered up. So we may well have somewhere, you know, 500-pound bomb or 1,000-pound bomb sitting around being quite happy in its state and at one point going off. And that's the reality.
Does that go through your mind when you're out in the field?
Of course you do.
I bet.
Look, it's It's I have done a lot of work in Micronesia, in the Marshall Islands, as their previous archaeologists. And there we are on one small island, which is, in, for your listeners, is Mili. It's about, I don't know, less than a mile long and three-quarters of a mile wide. It's a really tiny spot. We're still looking there for 10 tons of unexploded ammunition. We know that at least that's still there. So it's just horrific. You just have to live with it, and you just work with it, which means, thank God we didn't do any vegetation clearing. I've done work in Micronesia where you work with a machete to cut a gun free to look at it, and you cut something off and it goes ting, and you know exactly you hit a piece of metal, it shouldn't be there, and then you freeze. It's not that bad. It's there, you just got to live with it. You carefully look where you tread, where you can. You see an unexploded shell, you don't go and cuddle it. I mean, you walk past it, you walk away from it. You just have to manage it. If any major work has to be done, if you do excavations, you've got to be conscious of this. The ammunition is live. Some of it will have decayed and won't be. Some of it can be highly, highly live. It's a reality. It goes through your mind. You behave according to standards, and you just don't play with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I remember
the
being...
The real risk is that if there were visitors who don't... it has a strange fascination attraction. You know it's a potentially live shell, so is it or is it not? And there is this sort of attraction that you might want to have a look. You know what I mean. And yeah. So if a clown does that, then things can go wrong.
Yeah, I was told that when I was a kid, don't mess around with old dynamite.
Like you don't.
Because, yeah, don't. Right,
sorry, flippantly said, it might become a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and you don't want that.
Right. It's Talk of Alaska. Our guest, Peter Porco, and Dirk H.R. Spenneman, who will be back as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're going back more than 60 years to 1943 when the Japanese left Kiska Island and it was invaded by, or was reoccupied by American forces. And the American forces had friendly fire casualty, booby trap casualties mounting to the hundreds. The Japanese weren't even there anymore. And that island then was basically held by the American military for the duration. And then was abandoned and is pretty much the same way even now. And that makes for a fascinating archaeological situation, which Dirk Spenneman was able to explore as a consultant and is the basis, really, of this exhibition, ADAC and Kiska, which is up at the university, at the Anchorage Museum. Upstairs from the atrium, lining the halls, and it's kind of good. You don't have to step back very far. You want to look real close at this stuff, and I understand also this exhibition will be traveling. The land is managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and this exhibition, or at least parts of it, will probably be moving around. Dirk is talking to us from out in Shemya in the Aleutians, and also with us is Peter Porco. He's the playwright of Wind Blown and Dripping. He did a whole lot of research on Dashiell Hammett and his, what was it, a year, a little bit more than a year out in the Aleutians?
Hammett spent almost 2 years in Aleutians. Yeah.
Yeah. And Dirk, before we took the break, we had a call from Haynes who said, you know, I had heard that the American vets were not very happy about the memorial that the Japanese put up on Attu. I wonder if you know anything about that.
I've heard about it. Look, I've not been to Attu, and I haven't seen the memorial in my own with my own eyes, and I also haven't talked to the vets or have done any real research on it. I understand when it was put up with the full approval of veterans organizations, the full approval of the state of Alaska and the Fish and Wildlife Service as a memorial to both sides. So at that time, it was, as far as I understand, totally approved by veterans, U.S. veterans as well. I don't know the background detail, and it's an issue which the land managers, the Fish and Wildlife Service, have to deal with. It's an interesting thing when you look at memorialization from an academic perspective, but as I said, I haven't done the background detail, so I wouldn't feel comfortable to comment on something where I'm not firmly in the saddle.
Yeah, I can understand.
It's an interesting topic, and I can understand that it's evocative and emotive for a lot of people.
You wouldn't believe it when the feelings. Are just like yesterday. I think, like my dad, for instance, who was a World War II veteran and who we lost a few years ago, he would rarely talk about his experiences. And so the feelings were very intense because they were buried. They never came out. So you can understand that they got really upset, for instance, about the Enola Gay exhibition at the Smithsonian a few years ago. The Enola Gay was the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and the feeling was that the exhibition was indulging in revisionism, and that we should not be so charitable toward the Japanese side. And in fact, Senator Ted Stevens saw to it that exhibition was modified. You know, the old Flying Tiger himself. So, you know, these feelings are still, you know, they can even pass on generations.
I'm aware of that. And I think the very important part for any veteran who is listening is, of the Aleutian campaign is listening, is that the U.S. Park Service's World War II in the Aleutians historic area under Janice Koslowski is actively interviewing U.S. veterans, and they're very actively seeking veterans' reminiscences, their experiences, as well as historic imagery, etc. they may have. And I think this is a very laudable and very important element that the Park Service understands that that is an essential part, that veterans are dying, and they're very actively collecting. So if anyone's out there, I would recommend that they contact the Anchorage Regional Office and contact Janice or her staff to facilitate this. And it is through her offices and the work done by the Park Service, for example, that we had access to imagery by Sam Maloof, as one of them, for example, who, the known artisan woodworker, craftsperson, who has taken a lot of images, both formally, which is, you know, the normal military imagery you have, but also personal images. And there is a very different feel to the war. You've seen U.S. veterans looking at their life, what they see through their eyes. And this is the stuff which war histories don't get, which you do get through cartoons, which I like that Peter's comment is really great on the cartoon issue, because I've seen, there's a Kiska newspaper, the Volcano News, which I think had about 10 issues or so. So even the small garrison here had a Ronio-typed newspaper. And the cartoons, of course, since ancient Greek plays, basically, it's the one way you have to criticize the authorities without being seen to criticize them. Yes. So you don't get, there's no in American terms, no blowback if you do it that way.
You have, you have Sam Maloof. Foot Locker actually on exhibition as part of that thing. And that brings up a question here from Joette, who says, my dad was a medic stationed in Alaska during the war. He served in the Aleutians, and I have a copy of his book. He has this book, The Battle of the Aleutians, written by Corporal Dashiell Hammett and Corporal Robert Kolodny. I didn't see that in the exhibition. Do you have a copy of that in there?
No, I don't think so. The exhibition is a tripartite exercise. It's put together by the Anchorage Museum as far as the artifacts are concerned, and the U.S. National Park Service as far as the imagery is concerned, with research and other material put in from my end.
Pete Porco, you must have read that book.
I did. It was republished, I want to say sometime in the early 1980s, by Alaska Northwest Publishing. Terrence Cole was the editor, and he included that particular text along with The Battle of Attu by those who fought it. And these are personal reminiscences, pretty riveting battle memoirs. And so they were all put together in this one volume. But the original was a small booklet. And it was written by Hammett and Kolodny. Kolodny was an historian and a professor, and he was stationed on ADAC, too. He did the research. He wrote the first part of it. It had a lot of political ideology. Hammett took that out of it, and he rewrote it. And and Hammett did a great job on it. It's not a very long piece, but it summarizes the battles Attu, the Komondorsky's Attu, and Kiska.
So it's probably, first off, it's been republished, but even the original ones probably are not all that rare. If we were on Antiques Roadshow, Joette, I'm not sure you have a gold mine here.
I found a copy online, actually, and bought a copy. I read that there were about 100,000 printed.
All right.
Of that, and yeah. It's also, by the way, you can read it online. You can read the original and look at it as a PDF or a PowerPoint.
One thing that was brought up during the Dirk mentioned during his presentation, which I hadn't heard, but it would be nice if it happens, and that is if the John Huston propaganda film could be shown. Do you think we'll get that?
I understand it's planned that it's in summer during the summer that will be shown. I mean, it's available on video, etc. Yeah, this is an interesting image. I mean, it's the footage is the nice thing. The nice thing about the John Huston film is that it's color. And if we see sometimes World War II by nature of the photography in black and white, and it's actually colored, which makes it very different. You know, it's a very different psychological perception if you look at a black and white, grainy black and white image, or if you're looking at a color film. So, of course, it's a propaganda film, and it's very carefully cut. A photographer to a degree, I enjoy this. There is great imagery of reflections and other things.
You know,
the cinema photographer must have had a great ball at getting people lined up. It's really well done.
You know, and also it is propaganda, of course, because from the American perspective, from the perspective of that film, the bombing of Kiska was rather successful. And Dirk, you know that a lot of them missed their targets. So, but not in that film. It's a great film. It's a great piece of movie making. I mean, it was made by John Huston, and he also narrates it too. And he's got a wonderful narrator.
Oh, he does.
Style. Yes,
tremendous voice.
Yeah.
Well, Dirk, in your presentation, you do something pretty remarkable, where you show a Japanese motion picture. And I don't know if this is trickery or what, but you show a plane being shot down, and then you show the plane on the ground from in contemporary times, and then you show what's left of that plane on the ground from space or from Google Earth, and then you show it from on the ground as it is now.
Yes, this is the richness of the fabric which we have at the Battle of Kiska. Now that we've got the access to the Japanese end as well, is that we have both this is one of those great examples but this is pure. I mean, it's a really horrible thing, because if you reflect on it, you see this burning wing and fuselage coming down, and you know people are dying there or already dead, and that's really horrible. But I think at the same time, it brings, if you reflect on this, brings back the brutality of war, that people actually die rather than it's so many dead, which is some sort of arcane sanitized statement. So many people fell. This is literally brings it home, and then being able to see, okay, here is a Japanese photo. Look, a Japanese looking at the wreckage. Then the modern photography, it happens to be visible on the space because it just reflects. But you then have the Japanese, the modern photography showing what's still left on the ground, and you've got that evidence, and you know this is one occasion. Now, by pure chance, of course, that happened in the first days of the war, when also American pilots weren't as experienced yet. So they came in too low. They didn't understand the accuracy of the Japanese anti-aircraft fire. There was an underestimation by the U.S. side as to what the Japanese might or might not be able to do. And so as a result, of course, they then flew higher. But, it's one of those elements where everything comes together. And you literally have the direct connection of a modern historic object, which is that plane wing, in its location where it fell, all the way back to the event when it happened. And from a historic preservation perspective, that is, of course, the ultimate direct connection, but it's also then a direct memorial to the people who died in that particular event.
Very much so. And that's part of the eloquence, I think, of the color photographs, too, all the rust and the guns and so forth, that that feeling of casualties is always with you, I think, and that's part of what is speaking out from that. Let's go to Pat, joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Pat.
Yeah, hi. This is Pat Holmes from Kodiak, and I've been in and out of the Aleutian since 63 and worked with ADF&G for 25 years and have been out in that neck of the woods on several projects. And I'd suggest to the historians on the Battle of Attu that you should, what's been missing in a lot of the things that I've read in recent years is a perspective of the Attu and Onongan folks. And there's a few of them that are still alive on Atka. And one of the lads that there's a picture of the Japanese sergeant with an Attu boy on his shoulders. And I believe that was one of the Golodovs. I'm not sure. You can call me after the program. I left Lori my number. And but he's still alive. And if you talk to the folks, some of the Onongan folks, they have some different recollections than what was in Garfield's book and some other people's publications on the actual invasion itself. And I think that would be really good for the public edification. And then on the person that's working on Dashiell Hammett, I'd greatly appreciate it if you might know the answer to this, but probably 25, 30 years ago, I read a book that I think Dashiell Hammett wrote under a name de plume, or nom de plume, about the Aleutians. And I'm darned if I can remember his name, his name that he wrote under, because he was in the Army at the time and wasn't supposed to do it, or the name of the book, but I'd sure like to find that back again and get it for our local historical society. And but anyway, it's certainly a fantastic area. I didn't find out till you were talking about veterans and their reluctance to talk about it, and I unfortunately didn't find out till after my uncle William Holmes died that he was a naval ordnance disposal officer at Attu during the war.
Wow.
And that he and his chiefs had disarmed, I guess, one of the first Japanese mines of the war, and so that kind of set the pace for the invasion in the Pacific on knowing how to disarm those puppies. And he ended up getting a letter of citation from Secretary of War Navy Knox. And so there's all sorts of small, arcane things that one never knows about from your own relatives.
Yeah.
And anyway, I appreciate all the things folks are doing because that's always been a really special place that's been close to my heart. And anyway, good luck, and I appreciate your endeavors.
All right, Pat. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Pete, before you respond on the issue of Dashiell Hammett, let's take a quick break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Mm-hmm. Man, we are just burning up the minutes here, and we just don't have that much time left. Pete Porco, author of Windblown and Dripping, do you know of a book that Hammett might have been working on while he was up there?
He was at times making notes for a novel that he wanted to write again, and he would occasionally mention it in his letters, but I know of no, and I've heard of no other book that he wrote ever under a pseudonym or a nom de plume. Very early in his career, he wrote under another name briefly, but that was at the start. But in terms of the Aleutians, no. I mean, he wrote Battle of the Aleutians. He's the principal author on it. He wrote many letters from the Aleutians to friends, including Lillian Hellman and others, his daughters, his wife, and he never mentioned it at all.
I gotta say, it strikes me as a little bit strange when you think of him and Lillian Hellman as being kind of leftists, that he was so gung-ho on this war.
Well, from his perspective, it was a leftist war. It was an anti-fascist war. I mean, we were fighting the Axis powers. They were all fascist. And that made no contradiction for him. The only contradiction was when...
He was on the same side with Stalin, so it was fine.
Well, yeah, and the problem he had, of course, is when Stalin and Hitler signed their pact, and that during that those few years before Hitler invaded Russia, there was a bit of a kind of mental twist he had to do, but...
I'll bet there was. Dirk Spenneman, turning to the other half of our caller, Stu, from fascinating call from Kodiak... that's something that every historian wants to do now, isn't it? Get in touch with the native people that whose stories maybe haven't been pulled together even now.
Yeah, that's actually happening right now. There's a number of recollections are being edited. It's actually a project again by the Park Service looking at the, because of their responsibility of some of those areas. It's actually being carried out right now. So some of that work's done, being processed right now, and yes, it's important, and yes, that particular image is intriguing. He was referring to the Japanese soldier with an elderly guy, elderly child in the back, and another one laughing as well. I actually talked to the company commander who was the first to land on Attu and to occupy Attu and raise the Japanese flag, Mr. Osamu Toshiharu. And from his perspective, of course, the whole relations were quite amicable while on island. And I have I have access to, but not can't be showing at the moment until the permissions by the families are given, the Japanese owners of those images, a whole array of images of earlier Japanese interaction on Attu in the months before September 42, and the imagery is very intricate, very very close collaboration, working joint fishing, etc. Lots of images of Aleuts fishing by themselves, stuff which hasn't been seen before, which is quite spectacular. I'm trying to look at some of those, the faces, because you look at a person's face, and you can see whether not always, but you can try and see whether it's a forced smile or a genuine smile. And, you know, there's always a problem. I don't know the Aleut habit enough to see, to recognize a forced smile that easily. But the imagery looks to be reasonably genuine, which indicates that, well, and you have to admit at the same time as well, the Japanese occupied. But there was no real war going on. Attu was beyond Kiska. There wasn't much in terms of bombing, etc. So they were an occupying force. But they themselves had no interest of being, you know, horrible at the time, simply because why should you? They were just happily coexisting at that particular point in time. And then, of course, they were taken prisoner of war and taken back, just as much as Aleuts were moved from the eastern islands to ensure that they don't be out of harm's way. And then things turned differently, but that kind of research is going on. And I think there is a motherload of information which can come out of Japan if the right questions are being asked. That's going to go happen. But may I make my other comment on Pat? He commented on the mine stuff that his father or uncle was removing mines. When the U.S. took Kiska, they had an intelligence coup because they got hold of one of the most modern anti-aircraft guns the Japanese ever produced. Which was meant to go to Midway, but ended up on Kiska. And that basically allowed them to assess the anti-aircraft strengths of a lot of Japanese modern warships because they had fully operational guns available. So the Japanese, the American intelligence went to town on Kiska and pulled out all sorts of bits and pieces. The thing they couldn't pull out was aircraft, because what was left was heavily damaged. But by the time the American intelligence came around to investigate the Japanese aircraft remains, U.S. soldiers had gone and basically cut out everything useful as souvenirs. And so I have an intelligence report who is totally, the officer is totally frustrated that, you know, well, I'm here 4 weeks later and there's nothing to be had.
Oh, those GIs.
Basically stripped clean.
Kilroy was here. Let's go to Sean, joins the program from Heidelberg. Sean, you just got a minute or so.
Hi, Steve. Thanks. I really enjoy your program. I got out of the military in 1974 and joined the Teamsters Union as a surveyor, and I wound up having to go up to the Aleutians and spend 8 months in Attu and Chemia. And I couldn't believe how much there were still minefields back there then. Huh. And I got back and I did some research, and I read a book by Brian Garfield called World War II in the Alaska and the Aleutians.
Right.
And I found out a very, very nice thing, that the P-51 Mustang that probably won us the war was made by Boeing, because one of the Japanese pilots, the fighter pilots, he had a severed oil line to the oil meter on the dashboard, and he thought the whole engine was shot. He ditched it. He flipped over, broke his neck. They took the thing apart, and they brought it to Boeing, and Boeing made the P-51 Mustang.
A reverse engineering. Fascinating story, Sean. Thank you very much. We're just about out of time. Tom Walker said, hey, what about Jim Reardon's books? What about Kastner's Cutthroats? What do you think, Pete?
I've taken a look at Kastner's Cutthroats. Yeah, they were the guys who went in on, I think, on ADAC first to just make sure that there was nobody there.
Uh-huh.
Am I right about that? Or they may have landed on that too now. I'm forgetting which one. But in any case, they were a kind of a reconnaissance party.
Yeah. Dirk Spenneman, we just got about a minute left. Is your work complete? Do you get to continue with this?
Look, the annoying thing about research is that you solve one question and generate 10 more in the process. Of course, no. It's not going to be finished. I have to work on with the Park Service on the management plan for the battlefield. There will be all sorts of other follow-up issues. The opening up of the Japanese access through my colleague, Dr. Higuchi, means that we'll be able to pull out more material from there. The Japanese archives are very arcane, but they've opened up, so there is material forthcoming. I think the Aleut question raised is really important. So no, this is not the end of it. This is the beginning, literally the very, very beginning of a long story.
Oh, boy. Well, thank you so much. And thanks to the Air Force for arranging the connection. Dirk Spenneman, God be with you. Pete
thank
Porco,
you.
Thank you so much for being
good
with
to
us.
Good to be here, Steve.
Talk of Alaska. It's going to be foster care, the subject in the next Talk of Alaska. Dave Waldron on the controls, Lynn Anderson and Lori Townsend on the telephones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and by BP, unlocking Alaska's energy potential. Does your child not look at you when you talk to him? Are you worried your child doesn't play with other children? Or do you wonder why your child seems to be in her own world? Well, these could be the early signs of autism. For more information about autism and resources in your community, visit autism.alaska.gov or call 1-800-799-7570. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.